This month, we are celebrating the 50th from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama. The first, on March 7, was met with force. And that march was turned back with billy clubs, tear gas, bullwhips, and rubber tubing wrapped in barbed wire. Bloody Sunday, it was called, took place on the Edmund Pettus Bridge. On March 9, 2 days later, Martin Luther King Jr. led a symbolic march to the bridge. And on March 21, King led the five-day march all the way to the Capitol. Less than 5 months later, President Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act. These marches began at Brown Chapel AME Church. The church also hosted the Southern Christian Leadership Conference for the early months of 1965. The members of this church and other churches were active and centrally engaged in the struggle. About 8 weeks ago, another event took place. There was a traffic jam in the skies over Davos, Switzerland, caused by the private jets that were bringing the world's elite to the 43rd conference called the World Economic Forum. The jets were bringing the world's most rich and famous and powerful business figures, many of the politicians they fund, and of course, celebrities, to this conference. There, before the after party, they discussed the theme of the conference, the new global context. This new global context? Well, to quote a report published by Oxfam just before the conference, quote, the richest 1%, the attendees of this conference, the richest 1% have seen their share of global wealth increased from 44% in 2009 to 48% in 2014. Of the remaining 52% of global wealth, 46% is owned by the rest of the richest fifth of the world's population. The remaining 80% of the population possesses 5.5% of global wealth. At this rate, the wealthiest 1%, discussing the world's problems so seriously in Davos, will own more wealth of the world's wealth than the rest of the world combined. I wonder how many followers of Jesus Christ are counted among this 1%. On the road to Jerusalem, Jesus and his disciples chatted. In the lead, Jesus struck up a conversation after breakfast while the amazed and the fearful trailed behind. At one rest stop, Jesus took his disciples aside, telling them, "We're going to Jerusalem, and the human one," meaning himself, "will be handed over to the chief priests and the legal experts. They will condemn him to death and hand him over to the Gentiles. They will ridicule him, spit on him, torture him, and kill him. After 3 days, he will rise up." James and John, right after that, they must have been in the restroom while Jesus was talking, because right after Jesus mentions the betraying and the condemning, the ridiculing, the spitting, the torturing, and the killing, they ask him for places of status and power in his glory. "Could you exalt us, O Lord?" You see, the disciples wanted to fly to Davos, but Jesus was taking them to Selma. This is the last Sunday in the season of Lent. And this season we have been traveling on the road to Jerusalem with the rebel Jesus. For those who have been reading along with us the Mike Slaughter's book, The Renegade Gospel, we have met the rebel Jesus who came to bring radical change. Jesus came to planet Earth as a peacemaker, Slaughter writes, but he was not a peacekeeper. Claiming this rebel Jesus following him, becoming his disciple, Slaughter claims, quote, requires a radical reprioritization of all that we deem valuable. All we deem valuable. Now, these statements require unpacking, but they get at the very gist of the passage that we have before us this morning. Can you drink the cup I drink, or receive the baptism I receive? Jesus asked. We can, replied James and John. A little cocky they are, I would say. They are certainly there when the crowds are present at that peasant procession into Jerusalem, but when Jesus sips from the cup later, when he becomes the target of the powers that be, when he is baptized by their billy clubs and rubber tubing wrapped with barbed wire, they disappear. Disappointed that a jet will not be coming to pick them up anytime soon for the next conference of the elite. I don't think Mark means for us to shake our finger at James and John. I believe that the bluster and anger of the other disciples exposes them and exposes us to the truth that we all tend to be James and John. We are all sons of Zebedee. We are all doing our best in a world that lives this way, in a vertical, hierarchical world that puts one over another. We live in a world that is vertical this way. Those who have power and wealth lord over those who don't. If you want to survive, you learn how to get along this way. You play the game. But Jesus subverts the game. He subverts the vertical, oppressive world and sets us free. Did you hear the word from Paul's letter to the Philippians? When Jesus is celebrated as Lord, it's the kind of Lord that comes to us and sets us free and places not us one over the other, but all of us side by side and arm in arm. Jesus as Lord is not about grinding us under the thumb. It's about setting us free. In this text, as in Jesus' whole life and ministry, as in the prophets of the Old Testament, as in the Garden of Eden at the very beginning of the story, Jesus says, it is not so among you and will not be so among you. God takes our world that works this way and through the cross redeems it and then calls us to live this way in it. Living this way tends to be narrow, unforgiving, particularly for those who don't measure up or fit in the traditional molds. It is a competitive, dog-eat-dog world based on zero-sum logic. It pushes a self-centered focus, and it's exhausting. But that's not the way it will be among you. Living this way, side by side, is broader, more open. You don't have everything on top of you. You don't have everything, all the weight of the world sitting on your chest, taking your breath away, and you don't have to step on others to find air to breathe. In fact, to live like this, side by side, is to live for others, and everyone is blessed. The world that lives this way can have its moments, but sooner or later, depending upon where you are on the ladder, it inevitably gets ugly for many, for most. And we followers of Jesus are invited to make a choice. Do we want to go to Davos, or are we on our way to Selma? Did you catch Jesus He sounds so confident when he says, "But that's not the way it will be with you." He sounds as if he knows what our choice will be. Mike Slaughter, in his book, is less positive in his evaluation of Jesus' disciples. "We have kept Jesus on a leash," he writes. "It's so easy to seek the gifts of God," he continues, "rather than seek the God who gives." As I look at my own life and the life of the church, as I listen to the loudest voices who proclaim an imperial Jesus, and as I hear the deafening silence of those who could be proclaiming the rebel Jesus, my own moments of silence contributing. As I experience all these things, although I am touched by Jesus' seeming confidence, I am afraid that we are too often like Simba, looking into the water when he hears Mufasa, his father's voice, "You are more than what you have become." Who is more right in their evaluation of Jesus' followers? Jesus or Slaughter and Mufasa? That's a juicy question, but the one that is before us in this moment are the choices that we make today. Davos and Selma sound as if they are so far away, but we have Davos and Selma moments and choices in our lives, in our day, every day. The legislature, the Utah State Legislature, the ones we vote into office, have once again failed to pass any form of Medicare expansion, leaving thousands without access to health insurance. We continue to drag our feet on doing anything communally to work toward cleaner air. Will we choose to live like this? Or do we choose to live like this? What does living like this look like in Logan, Utah? At the same time, people continue to feed each other and care for each other generously here in this valley. And we have passed anti-discrimination legislation. We continue with struggles in the mainline church, and at the same time, we have a vital message to share. Recently, in the first grassroots national vote, the PCUSA, our denomination, has expressed that the gift of marriage belongs not just to a man and a woman, but to two people, whatever their gender or orientation. We've withdrawn, as a denomination, our money from firms that enable the occupation of Palestinian land, but continue to invest in companies that contribute and are the main contributors to climate change. Your perspectives on these issues will vary, but the question remains, what does it look like to live like this in Logan, Utah? Struggled with this in Sunday school class in the discussion. I listened in, and the individual said, "It's so hard. It's so draining as individuals to always be giving, 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 giving. What are we supposed to do? Give every second? That's what Jesus makes it sound like. It's not possible." But I don't think Jesus talks in such stark terms to make us feel guilty. Part of the redefining of the renegade gospel is that it is a communal word, not an individual word. We die and we live together, side by side, supporting and loving each other, teaching and learning from each other. Whereas the cynicism of the world says that all that effort is a great big zero, we say that when we join together in the presence of the God of hope and we live like this, we live and share hope and joy and love and true community and justice. What does living like this look like in Logan, Utah? This is the question that is sent before the disciples of Jesus in this place. Once we have been amazed by His love, once we have been empowered by His wisdom and grace, once we have been inspired by His march to Jerusalem and transformed by His embrace of the cross, what does living like this look like in Logan, Utah? You are the only one that can finish this sermon. Amen.